You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hi, Anders.
Hi, Bob.
How are you doing?
Oh, very well, thank you.
Good. Let me introduce us. I'm Robert Wright, publisher of the Non-Zero Newsletter. This is the Non-Zero Podcast. You are Anders Osland, a well-known economist. One thing that's very relevant to the conversation today is that you, in the 90s, served as an advisor first to the Russian government and then to the Ukrainian government. You're author of a lot of books, including most recently, Russia's Crony Capitalism, The Path from Market Economy to Kleptocracy. You've served in the Swedish diplomatic corps. You've been at a lot of think tanks in Washington. And let me tell people the way this conversation took shape. So I did a piece for the Washington Post, an op-ed that was called,
Biden can help Zelensky and Ukraine by pushing for peace, published on the 4th of December.
Well, thank you. I'm flattered that you've committed it to memory. I'm not sure I should be, though, because what happened was you took sharp exception to it, did a long Twitter thread criticizing it, got a lot of attention, but you have a lot of Twitter followers, like 300,000 or something, and I gather that a number of them feel passionately about the war in Ukraine, as many people do. I said, do you want to debate this? I figured it would be faster than replying to everything you said on Twitter. You kindly obliged. So let me start by just quickly saying what my piece was about. It was, you know, there's been talk about the possibility of the war ending through peace talks and the possibility of the U.S. using its leverage as Ukraine's main arms supplier to kind of push Ukraine toward the peace table. That's often depicted as the U.S., you know, in the name of its own, in pursuing its own interests, pushing Ukraine to do something the Ukraine doesn't consider in its interest. I made the argument that actually a near-term peace could be in Ukraine's interests. That was a lot of what my argument was about. You wrote in your first tweet, today, the Washington Post has published an article by Robert Wright, Biden can help Zelensky in Ukraine by pushing for peace, which illustratively gets everything wrong. Oh, you're too kind. Anyway, it says, which illustratively gets everything wrong. Let me point out what is wrong. Now, I don't think you meant factual errors. I think you meant wrong in some deeper and more fundamental sense. What?
It's not the facts, it's the logic of the argument.
It's the logic. So what's the main, is it possible to say what the main objection is or what the main objections are?
The main objection is that Putin has never stuck to any international agreement that he or Russia have made. So he's not a reliable party. And if one stops so that Putin gets any gain from this war, he will just wait and come back later on. First, he got Sevastopol from an agreement from 97. And then he renegotiated that in 2010. Next, he used the Sevastopol base on Crimea in order to take the whole of Crimea. After that, in 2014, he sent in his special forces in various parts of Ukraine and more or less saw what is happening. And when it didn't work very well, he sent in regular troops and got to a ceasefire agreement that he never stuck to in September 2014. Then he went for another ceasefire agreement after another minor offense. It's more or less to straighten out the front. And we have Minsk II in February 2015. After that, Putin sits back, mobilizes his forces, built up his forces, and then he goes for a full-fledged attack in February 2022, trying to take the whole of Ukraine. So if he gets any benefit now, then he will just wait and take the rest of Ukraine, or try to take the rest of Ukraine when he can.
Before I get into that, let me ask you, how could you be any more certain that he wouldn't attack again if you rolled his troops all the way back to the border? I mean, in other words, you're saying you can never rest. There's never going to be a secure agreement with Russia. There will always be the threat that as soon as they feel they can get away with it, they'll attack Ukraine. So you don't see any stable agreement ever with Russia.
I think that Putin has to be beaten. And I say intentionally Putin rather than Russia. Russia in the 1990s was a very different place. So it's Putin who is just like Hitler. He has made his political career on war. The war in Chechnya, the war on the oligarchs was not a real war. The war on Georgia in 2008, the war on Ukraine in 2014. And now he started another war in 2022. He needs war in order to justify more repression at home and to get more popularity. Popularity is important for Putin, although he's not the least democratic.
Yeah, I know it's important for all leaders. So let me say on the, first of all, the list of agreements, the things you said he'd violated, there's, of course, disagreement between the two sides over who violated what. I would say the most important of the agreements you mentioned were the Minsk agreements after 2014, which in principle could have avoided war by granting autonomy to two of the oblasts in the Donbass. Now Russia's claim is that Ukraine failed to deliver on those. And of course, it's true that Ukraine, having agreed to them at the bargaining table, never actually passed them via parliament. And I want to say there's something, here's something that Jack Matlock, who of course was a U.S. ambassador to the Soviet Union under, I think, Reagan, recently said, quote, "The war might have been prevented, probably would have been prevented, if Ukraine had been willing to abide by the Minsk agreement, recognize the Donbass as an autonomous enemy within Ukraine, avoid NATO military advisors, and pledge not to enter NATO." So at least the opinion of a former U.S. ambassador to Russia is that actually it was Ukraine that failed to deliver on the Minsk agreement. Apparently you have a different view. But I just wanted to establish that the things you, your characterization of who has violated which agreements is not universally accepted. Okay.
Now, Jack Matlock has been utterly pro-Putin for many years. When he was ambassador in Moscow, I worked at the Swedish embassy in Moscow at that time, and he did a very good service then. But in recent years, he has been all in favor of Putin and Moscow and all against Ukraine. So he stands out. You can take Alexander Vershpaw, Michael McFaul, as other U.S. ambassador to Moscow, who take vehemently the opposite position. But the essence of the Minsk agreements was that they were ceasefire agreements, mm-hmm. which Russia never stuck to. They forced Russia to withdraw its heavy arms from occupied Donbass. No, I don't consider this autonomous regions. I consider them regions occupied by Russia because they commanded by Russians and by Russian generals. So Russian occupied territories, I call them. And Russia did not comply with these basic rules. So therefore, why the rest? And then autonomy, Ukraine's far-reaching decentralization essentially complies with the demands for autonomy in these territories. And Russia is not a democracy. It's a hard-lined dictatorship. So how can we discuss any elections as the Russians wanted to have while they had occupied these territories?
Let me say on the ceasefire issues, I know there's the Russian side of the story of that too. I'm not an expert. I can't speak to this, But I know there are genuine controversies. On the Minsk issue, I know that Matlock is far from the only respected mainstream figure in the U.S. who says that Ukraine failed to deliver on what it had promised at the negotiating table. And a lot of people have said the U.S. failed to push Ukraine toward that. And that, at that point, let me ask you, though, when you say Matlock, this former ambassador to the U.S. is pro-Putin, do you mean he's what? He's not serving, he's disloyal? What are you saying? He favored Russian interests over American interests? What are you saying?
He is favoring Russian interests over Ukrainian interests for many years now, as you can see from his public statements, not when he served in Moscow and not when he served in the White House, but in recent years. This is a recent development. I don't think that is that interesting that I would check when he changed view, but it's something like...
So you're not saying he's a disloyal American. You're saying he's not serving Ukrainian interests.
It's very common that people who have served in Moscow as a journalist or diplomats, that they think that Russia has a right to dominate over other countries.
Okay. Now, let's talk about your depiction of Putin as someone who kind of relentlessly invades places. I mean, I first of all, I take this very seriously. I'm very interested in trying to foster respect for international law. That's why I've complained when the U.S. has violated it by invading countries, as with the Iraq War, and I think most people would say the Kosovo intervention and so on. But I'd like to challenge your view that Putin has kind of from the beginning shown this tendency to invade countries, and from the beginning, he's violated agreements with the U.S., and this was just his character all along. Now, it seems to me that, I mean, you mentioned Chechnya. Well, of course, Chechnya is part of Russia, and I'm not defending how brutally the separatist uprising in Chechnya was suppressed, but that's not violating international law. It's not in the sense of transborder aggression. It's not an invasion. So, if you ask when did he first arguably invade a country, that would be Georgia, I think, in 2008, the incursion having to do with the, you know, the Russian-speaking part of Georgia and so on. So he had been in power for 8 years at that point, hadn't invaded any countries. And his view, I know, and it may not be right, is that the U.S. had not done its part in what he had hoped would be a partnership. I mean, for example, in 2000, right after the 9/11 attacks, he calls the Bush administration, says, I'm here to help. And they did, Russia did extend genuine help with Afghanistan and so on. Within a few months, Bush did something that Putin had really implored him not to do. Bush withdrew from the anti-ballistic missile treaty, something which a lot of mainstream American arms control experts say was stupid, even from America's point of view. But in any event, from Putin's point of view, that's America withdrawing from an agreement it had made. And Putin has his whole list of things, including of American violations of international law, including the Iraq invasion in 2003 and so on. And as I'm sure you know, in 2007, he still hasn't invaded any countries. He knows, I think, at the Munich conference, he delivers a speech about how rampantly the U.S. has violated international law and says, you know, he's clearly a very unhappy camper at that point. Now, that's a critical period because in 2008, the issue arose as to whether we should extend to Ukraine a kind of vague promise for eventual NATO membership. Now, you talked about Jack Matlock. I want to ask you about another former U.S. ambassador to Russia, Bill Burns. He was ambassador to Moscow then. And he sent an email to Condoleezza Rice, then the Secretary of State, basically just saying, do not make this mistake. I have talked to everyone in the Russian national security establishment. Well, no, he didn't say everyone. He said, I've talked to people throughout the establishment. This isn't just Putin. All Russian national security elites are dead set against extending NATO membership to Ukraine. It's a red line, don't do it. He then separately sent a memo that got wide distribution in the administration about Ukraine membership in NATO, and it was called Nyet Means Nyet. So he was saying, and he specifically predicted, we could have trouble in eastern Ukraine, we could have war, and so on. So, and again, at this point, Putin has not done the things you're talking about in terms of invading any countries. Bush basically says, look, I know best. He goes on, he promises membership to Ukraine, which I think kind of drove Putin crazy. In addition, Bush was at that point recognizing the independence of Kosovo, which is highly dubious under international law since our initial, for reasons I could get into if you want. I know you know that you know enough to know that Russia was very upset about.
But let me respond to these points. So, the important point here is how Putin's attitude to the U.S. Changed. And basically what you say is correct. I have no quarrel with the facts as you presented them. But the interpretation I would present is slightly different. I think that Strobe Talbot put it very well in his Russia memoir book, where he says that Putin wanted to get along with the US, but on his conditions. Mm-hmm. He was not prepared for the democracy thing. It's really democracy that is the serious break. And when Putin really got upset with the US, it was because of the Orange Revolution in Ukraine in late 2004, which he Putin thinks that everything is organized from Washington. Mm-hmm. So the question is only if it's the State Department or CIA that organizes it. It's not if Washington organizes it, which is, of course, completely wrong. And Putin was not prepared for what happened in Ukraine, which was fully democratic. This was a democratic protest against a stolen election. And his candidate, Viktor Yanukovych, had stolen it. Putin had even gone to Ukraine and campaigned for Yanukovych in a very expressed fashion. And then what did Putin do afterwards? In 2005, he adopted all these anti-democracy laws, which essentially prohibited NGOs from doing virtually anything and sharply reduced the freedom of speech.
This is in Russia, you mean?
In Russia in 2005. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So what Putin reacted against was democracy. And he was scared by democracy. And then we have his April 2005 State of the Union speech, where he calls the end of the Soviet Union the greatest geopolitical catastrophe of the 20th century. Mm-hmm. I mean, normally one would say Hitler or Holocaust is a major catastrophes of the 20th century, and the breakup of the Soviet Union was one of a nice, peace, largely peaceful events. And then we come to the February 2007 speech in Munich, which was straightforward anti-American.
Well, I think he was pointing to things we had genuinely done by way of violating international law and, you know, abandoning agreements we had made and so on. I think he had a lot of factual correctness also, in the indictment.
I don't disagree with that, but basically it was an anti-Western speech. Mm-hmm. And then we come to the Bucharest NATO summit in early April 2008. And what was right and wrong with that? My view is that any country that wants to join NATO should be allowed to, that qualifies, should be allowed to apply.
And to apply, or we should commit to accept?
Let me take it and explain. So Georgia and Ukraine did apply. The problem was that Bush got this idea very late. He picked it up in early January 2008. And the Germans and the French had been around Washington because they suspected that this would come up and asked in November, December, will this come up? And had been reassured by lots of Bush appointees, no, it will not happen. We guarantee you that. And then all of a sudden, Cheney and Bush, early January 2008, decide to change and start a big campaign. And it was too late done. Mm-hmm. It was poor policy making from Bush, and therefore it didn't work out. My view is that they should have been given membership action plans in April 2008. Instead, they get this strange statement that Ukraine and Georgia will become NATO members, but not a word is said about how that should be done. So this is sort of to put them up to be shot at. And in order to show that he didn't understand anything about diplomacy, Bush immediately afterwards went to see Putin in Sochi, if I remember rightly, 6th, 7th of April. And they composed a meaningless communique that Bush saw as his legacy on policy with Russia. And Putin understood that Bush won't do anything if I start military action. So then he prepared military action to take Tamposytsk and Abkhazia, which are not Russian ethnic territories, but have their own minorities with their own sensitive relations with Georgia. And he's prepared for an attack, that is Putin-prepared attack on Georgia. President Mikhail Saakashvili saw this and reacted against it. Right. And therefore, the Georgian troops moved first. And then you have two different interpretations.
Right.
Several Europeans claimed that it was Saakashvili who attacked, while the U.S. obviously saw that Russia had prepared an attack, and Saakashvili perhaps unwisely had countered it too early. So the U.S. Came in quite heavily in support of Saakashvili and managed to convince Putin stop it.
So, yeah, I think that's the conventional view of that, is Georgia did fire the first shot, technically started the hostilities, but Russia had been interested in kind of, you might say, baiting Georgia into that.
They had a full invasion underway.
Yeah, I don't want to get too deeply into how parallel Putin saw that as to what we were doing in Kosovo, but I would just say, I would just push to the side, this to the side. I don't want to spend time on it and say that I think if anyone's curious, I can make the argument that the parallels are maybe more striking than people might realize. In any event, that was a real sore spot with Putin. And
they hang together. Kosovo and Georgia hang together.
Yeah. And so let me ask you a couple of things. So just quickly, you think the problem with promising membership to Ukraine wasn't the fact that we did it, but kind of the way we did it. So in other words, you think Bill Burns, then the ambassador to Moscow, now the director of CI, was wrong to say this is just a bad idea flat out? You think he, like Ambassador Matlock, was wrong?
It's more difficult with Burns. You know, ambassadors by and large are thinking of the small steps. And the small step here would have been negative for the relationship. But if Ukraine had become a member of NATO and got on a solid track to become a member of NATO, it could not have happened fully because neither Georgia nor Ukraine at the time fulfilled the NATO membership conditions. Then I don't think that either of the war, the attacks on Ukraine would have happened. So you are only safe in that part of the world if you belong to NATO. This is the conclusion that Sweden and Finland have drawn up, and therefore,
Of course, course, the alternative view, which was advanced by a lot of people in the 90s when the decision to expand NATO was made, ranging from George Kennan to, you know, all kinds of noted figures, was that it is the expansion of NATO toward Russia's borders that it will see as threatening, which will make it the case that the only way to be safe is to be in NATO, because Russia will. In other words, there's this kind of joke about NATO that it exists to solve problems that its mission is to solve problems that its existence creates. There was something of that spirit in the argument being made by a lot of mainstream foreign policy figures in the 90s, is that if you push it toward Russia's borders, they're going to feel more and more threatened. And yeah, at that point, you may feel you need to be part of NATO, but that's not inherently the case. And I want to ask you a related thing. You I said earlier that.
Let me respond to that.
Okay, sure.
I don't disagree on this. I was pretty agnostic in the 1990s, but the fundamental principle is, if a country wants to apply for membership of NATO and they don't feel safe otherwise, then let them in. I think that we should be very happy today that the three Baltic countries did manage to become members of NATO, and therefore we have not had any problems on that side. Norway and previously Turkey always bordered on the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. And to be a NATO country and border on Russia is not a problem. The problem is since Russia became openly revisionist, and we can discuss if it's 2005, 2007, or 2008. Yeah. But at that time, the answer is clear.
And you know, part of this, there being revisionist is, you know, this is grounded in their perception of what's happening. And I, you just said, they tend to see threats like when there is, you know, in the Orange Revolution and these various revolutions, they see the State Department's hands and U.S. government hands. And I would say, well, first of all, there is some degree of encouragement of these things from the U.S. government, but I'll grant that it's probably, there is also tremendous indigenous energy behind it, you might say. But my question to you is, do you think Russia is any more inclined to overread threats than the U.S. was throughout the Cold War? I mean, I could give you tons of examples. We intervened far from our shores, as if what happened in Guatemala or someplace, you know, was I mean, even in the 80s, we invaded Grenada. Okay,
and I don't really want to get into
no,
this.
No, but it's a serious question. It's a serious question. Do we have the right to ask that Russia, you know, a great power with nuclear weapons, that is also a declining power and so may be particularly sensitive psychologically, is it smart of us to expect it to be any less paranoid than we have been? That's my question.
I don't put it in those terms. I think that it's always right to stand up for democracy, freedom, and human rights. And that's what I'm doing. And the Russia-Ukraine war, as it is now, it's really a question. Are you in favor of democracy? Or are you in favor of a dictatorship and kleptocracy? That's what we're discussing today.
I want to let's get back to that in 1 minute. One more question, though. Do you doubt that if Mexico said tomorrow, we're entering into a trade partnership with China, and also we have a mutual security pact, and they will be sending weapons and advisors, and maybe troops if we decide, to Mexico, which would be the equivalent of Ukraine joining NATO and the EU, do you doubt for a second that we would exercise whatever force was necessary to keep that from happening?
This is no topic that I discuss. I stick to what I know. I know Russia and Ukraine and Eastern Europe very well, and therefore I have a clear idea of what is the right and the wrong idea. How to predict how odd politicians in the US, such as Donald Trump, may behave or not behave is really not what I'm focusing on.
Okay. I have views on that, but I won't share them.
But that's
so you mentioned democracy. There's kind of two issues here. will Putin accept democracy in Ukraine? Will he accept it in Russia? Now, it's, I gather from your earlier recitation of the souring of relations between Russia and the U.S., that part of the problem you think is that he wouldn't accept democracy in Russia. That's like a big problem for you, right?
Yeah, he's the enemy of democracy and freedom in all its forms. Russia today has gone back to a Stalinist dictatorship. And I think that is pretty awful. And so do about one third of the Russians who have some view about these matters. So it's a big domestic constituency who's against it. I'm generally in favor of democracy. Yeah. And also, this is a massively kleptocratic regime where the top people have stolen hundreds of billions of dollars. Russia has not grown since 2014 and hardly at all from 2009. So Putin doesn't care about his people. He just uses it as a cannon fodder. I can see no reason to defend such a country in any regard.
Well, you know, I suspect he cares about his people in the sense that a lot of leaders do, which is that he wants them to have enough of a sense of well-being that they don't become a political problem for him and that they keep him in power. I think I would say a lot of leaders think that. But my main question
I wouldn't say that. He just wants to repress them. Russia today is enormously repressive. You would not say that Stalin cared about his people's well-being in any organizing massive famines within his countries repeatedly. Yeah.
I certainly don't doubt. I don't deny that he's made Russia more autocratic and authoritarian. My question is, how large should that consideration loom in our foreign policy? There are lots of countries, including some that are tantamount to allies. I mean, like you know, Saudi Arabia, Egypt. There are tons of countries that are as autocratic and authoritarian as Putin. And we just say, look, we just want to get along with you. What you do in your country is your business. And I really think as a practical matter, there's something to be said for that. Now, I don't think we should be giving weapons to these countries as we do. I don't think we should be subsidizing all the bad things done inside Saudi Arabia. But my question to you is why should we? I mean, look, it seems to me it's challenging enough to manage relations with a declining superpower that has nuclear weapons. And just keeping things on an even keel and keeping Europe stable and peaceful and prosperous and so on without demanding that we they overhaul their form of government, as much as I disapprove of it, right? I mean, I just don't, I like a lot of people, I don't agree that we can afford to go around demanding that other countries change the way they change their form of government in keeping with our ideals. It's just too hard to do all these things, and it gets in the way of just keeping avoiding wars, for example.
I think that one should push as much for democracy and human rights as one can. And
yeah, as one can, in some sense, we'd agree on that.
Policy has been to do the two things at the same time. And then the question is, how much can you do? And to my mind, Putin is to the same extent a dead ender as Hitler was. And it was new point in discussing with Hitler after 1941. And the West didn't do so. And in the same way, I think that we should just wait for Putin to collapse in one way or the other, since it makes no sense to make any agreement with him, since he doesn't abide by any agreement. Mm-hmm. We can abstain from that activity. So the only thing would be what the military call to make sure that their troops don't shoot on each other by accident. That is sort of how much activity one can have with the Russian government. Since the Russian diplomats now lie all the time, it's a good saying, don't believe in anything until the Kremlin has denied it. It's a ordinary diplomacy makes no sense. Of course, diplomats lie sometimes, but all the time. This is what the Russians are doing now. So this is an extreme case. I think that Iran is hardly worse than Russia is today. So Russia has ended up, because of Putin, in that category, which does not mean that Russia was like that in the 1990s. So therefore, I agree with your ambiguous ideas about what policy the West should have had towards Russia in the 1990s.
Okay, so your view is that now we should, you said, wait for Putin, the regime, to collapse. But I gather you want us to abet that process and make it more likely that that will happen. So you're in favor of, in some sense, a regime change policy?
Yeah, I mean, the U.S. Should stop backbinding the hands of the Ukrainians and put as much arms as possible into Ukraine. If you think of it now, the total Western military support for Ukraine, it's $40 billion. The U.S. aid is half of that. It's 10% of U.S. defense budget. And that has taken out approximately half of Russia's military capacity. No U.S. government expenditure has been more effective than the U.S. Military support to Ukraine. So then go further. You give the Ukrainians good military airplanes now, give them tanks and really long-distance missiles, and let the Ukrainians attack the Russian bases from which they are being attacked. At present, the Ukrainians are not allowed to do so with U.S. weapons. They can do so to a limited extent with their own weapons.
Okay, I wonder if you'd actually, in a way, like us to go even further than giving them whatever weapons they want. Here's something you tweeted right after the missile hit Poland. At first, we thought it was Russian. By the way, I didn't go back and dig this up after our recent encounter. I actually, in my newsletter, Non-Zero newsletter, I had already actually printed this tweet and commented on it. But what you said was, at long last, Russian missiles have hit Poland and killed two Polish citizens. Surprising it did not happen before, given irresponsible Russian behavior. POTUS, meaning Biden, you have promised to defend every inch of NATO territory. Are you going to bomb Russia now? Then you said a reasonable first NATO step would be to impose a no-fly zone over Ukraine to get rid of all the Russian air attacks on Ukraine. A good second NATO step would be to clean out the Russian Black Sea fleet, all-out attack on the Navy. That's my comment. And then you go on to say it is weak and easily harmful, but still block most of Ukrainian, maybe a typo there, Ukrainian shipping in the Black Sea. Then you say, this is time for NATO to prove that it exists. Now, in retrospect, I think you'll agree, you kind of jumped the gun. I mean, it turned out it wasn't a Russian missile. And I'm kind of curious as to why you thought, even if it was a Russian missile, it would be intentional, since I don't think Russia wants to get NATO involved. So I wouldn't expect Russia would intentionally strike Poland. But my larger question is, I kind of got the sense from this that maybe one reason you were so kind of ready to go at this point is that you actually wish NATO would enter the war now. Is that your view? Would you just like to see NATO get involved and turn this into a Russia-NATO war?
I find it quite, you have probably heard this, that the West is prepared to fight to the last Ukrainians.
I have.
It's not very moral that the West is using the Ukrainians as pawns in this. I would not, I shouldn't say that, but it leaves me in a very awkward situation. And I think that the Ukrainians are likely to react against the West later on. We have done it all and you are not doing more for us, which is the reason why I want the West to do as much as possible. Note that I posed the question that Biden has said this repeatedly. that he wants to defend every inch of NATO territory as an argument not to go in to Ukraine. So therefore, mm-hmm. I thought it worth posing the question. The no-fly zone, I take seriously, but the other was written fast and fastidiously. You shouldn't take it too seriously, but I'm happy that you do.
What, the things you said on Twitter, you mean?
The part about the Black Sea Fleet.
You weren't serious? That was like just...
A bit fastidiously stated. But the point is that Sevastopol should be lost for the Russians. As I said in the beginning, it was Sevastopol that was the basis for the Russian occupation of Crimea. Russia had 10,000 Marines who seized, or special forces that seized Crimea swiftly because they were mm-hmm. already based in Sevastopol. So therefore, you don't want the Russians to stay in Sevastopol, but it should not be done in that fashion.
Okay, so is it your view that, in fact, as suggested by some things you said about a minute ago, that this is, in a way, a proxy war between America and Russia, between NATO and Russia, and what we're doing now is using, I know you don't want to say we're using them as pawns, but for you to even walk up the line of saying that, suggests that you do see this as a great power struggle that employs proxies, right?
I would put it in a different way. Ukraine is defending the West against Russia. That's how I see it, which is quite a different way. And therefore, since Ukraine is defending us, or I'm Swedish, I see it as a European matter. Therefore, we, the West, have to provide Ukraine with as much equipment as possible. I clearly see that as an advantage to keep the war limited.
You really think if Ukraine weren't there to do the fighting, Russia would attack Poland, Germany? Is that what you're saying?
I think Moldova and the three Baltic states would come next. Putin's purpose is not to reestablish the Soviet Union, but to organize war so that he can repress his country more.
Well, he certainly wants to stay in power. He certainly seems willing to exercise what repression is necessary. I don't understand how attacking NATO makes him more likely to stay in power by any rational calculation. And I continue to think he's a rational person, however bad a person he may be.
I think that he intentionally disinforms himself. He doesn't believe in public information. He believes in his intelligence services, whatever they lie. And clearly, it was a very poorly informed attempt to seize Kiev. I think it was poorly informed rather than irrational.
Okay. Well, I guess I'd say my own view is that in attributing to him the the firm and unchangeable intention to attack NATO, it seems to me you are going as far beyond the actual evidence in seeing sinister motivations in your adversaries as you say he is when he sees, for example, the U.S. meddling in Ukraine. And I think at some point we should talk about 2014 in Ukraine, but that's just my view. You obviously disagree. You think you see the evidence. That would be a whole additional argument about things he actually has and hasn't said and why he said them.
Well, I do read. He has denied Ukraine's right to exist. He has openly called for genocide of the Ukrainians. He has accused the Ukrainians of genocide in Donbass, mm-hmm. which is complete nuts. So I read Putin a lot, and I read his big essay of 5,000 words on the 12th of July as a declaration of war on Ukraine. I said all along that Putin will attack Ukraine, as the U.S. government rightly said from October 2021.
Mm-hmm. I think. I think his intention to invade had, had gotten pretty firm by the summer. I don't think, and I think plans were in motion. I don't think that means the negotiations couldn't have stopped it. But
Putin denied it all the time.
Well, of course, if you're going to, you know, people who invade countries always deny it until they do it. They don't, you know, that's sadly, you know, the way these things happen. I mean, if he's going to invade a country, he's going to behave the way leaders behave who invade countries. I'm against the invasion. It was a violation of international law, but I don't think.
The U.S. did not deny that it was going to invade Afghanistan or that it was going to invade Iraq. The question was rather when and not if.
Those are slightly different kinds of operations, I would say. But and there wasn't kind of a plan of the sort Putin had to basically take them by surprise and do a coup and whatever. But that's another story. I would just say this doesn't, it doesn't, not announcing an invasion in advance doesn't separate him from the great bulk of leaders in the history of the world. I'm not defending him. I guess I'm just wondering to what extent we're justified in putting him in some kind of special category and saying he's not rational, he's not this,
he's not rational, but he lies all the time. So if you want to know what he does, it's better to turn around his faces.
I agree, he lies a lot. There's a couple of things I'd like to cover before we go. One is quickly, I want to eventually get a little more into my Washington Post op-ed and another aspect of it. I mean, so far we've just focused on your not thinking Russia can keep an agreement. I want to get back to that, but first, let's at least touch on 2014. There's a couple of things, I guess. Two aspects of 2014 I'm interested in. Of course, Putin read that as kind of a Western-sponsored coup or a Western-orchestrated violent revolution. I would say it's not as if he doesn't have. That's not the way I would characterize it, but I would characterize it as a somewhat violent revolution. And I would say the U.S. Had enough of a hand in things that it's not shocking he read it that way. Of course, it begins with the usual thing where National Endowment for Democracy, a U.S. government arm, and the U.S. Embassy are kind of funding things that, you know, you can see as these very worthwhile civil society projects and so on. But they were opposed to media outlets and so on, but they were opposed to the he's characterized as pro-Russian. Anyway, a somewhat amenable to Russia president of Ukraine, who had been democratically elected. So Putin, he didn't like them. But of course, then beyond that, there's the famous phone call where Victoria Nuland of the U.S. State Department is talking to U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, and they're basically talking about who they want to lead the government after the transition of power that hasn't happened yet. Then the transition of power happens violently in the sense that the president flees for fear of his life when there are armed opponents roaming the streets. You know, it was a somewhat violent revolution, regardless of your view on who fired first. And they are saying, well, I think Yats should be the guy. We'll have to go explain this to the other guys who might want the job. We'll get Biden involved. They mentioned Jake Sullivan. Biden was vice president then. And lo and behold, the guy they mentioned is the guy who winds up leading the government afterwards. Now, I'm not saying, I never call this a coup myself. It was a non-democratic transfer of power that involved violence. There was some degree of Western involvement. That's all I'm going to go so far as to say. My question to you is it surprising that any number of people in Putin's shoes would look at all this? And given the fact that he felt he very much had a stake in a deal he had made with that Ukrainian president, and that the successor was going to be very anti-Russian, assuredly, do you think it's surprising that Putin looks at that and says, this is the U.S. meddling in my backyard? They'd never tolerate that if I did it in Mexico or Canada or even Guatemala.
I think that this is a completely wrong interpretation of it. The fundamental thing that changed domestic politics in Ukraine, that's that Yanukovych on the 16th of January 2014 push through the so-called dictatorial laws, which corresponded to Putin's laws on 2005, that closed down all democracy and freedom, and you could get several years in prison for all kinds of democratic acts. And there were two big groups of oligarch deputies in parliament, and they were forced by Yanukovych to approve of these laws, but they were very unhappy. It was only a matter of time when they would rebel against Yanukovych. And they were about 100 members of parliament. And then the big thing that happened was that Yanukovych, or the Russians, we don't exactly know, ordered out special forces to shoot protesters. And about 125 people were killed in the streets of Kiev. And the whole thing came to a crunch 20th of February, when the parliament gathered and ousted Yanukovych with 2/3 majority. Putin had then already prepared the takeover of Crimea, which started, mm-hmm. according to the medals that the participants had received, on the 20th of February. Mm-hmm. Putin, this was just an excuse. He wanted to take Crimea, which would be very popular in Russia, and took his popularity rating, according to the Levada Center, to 88%. So this was the mm-hmm. real aim Putin had. And then on the 21st of February, Yanukovych flees from Kiev, and after a week, he turns up in Rostov in Russia. So Putin used this as an excuse. The Newland Pyatt call you're referring to happened later. It was not before, but after Yanukovych had been ousted. And it was the Ukrainian parliament that constituted itself. And Alexander Turchynov became the speaker of parliament and acting president, who came from Yulia Tymoshenko's party, non-oligarchic party. But it was the two big oligarchs who had been with Yanukovych who changed the situation. So this was entirely a domestic drama.
Okay, so of course, the two sides disagree over who fired first, and I am not an expert, but I'm sure you don't deny that.
That's obvious. It was the Yanukovych people who...
I've looked into it enough to think that it's not crystal clear to me, but we'll just have to leave it at that. I know the claim on the other side is that... I mean, you don't deny that there were armed militants who are intensely nationalistic. These are the people that Putin calls the neo-Nazis, but whatever. Intensely nationalistic, armed militants who were part of the what's called the Revolution of Dignity. You don't deny that they were there, right? And they pretty quickly got involved in the shooting. I mean, and I don't know who fired the first shot, but you don't deny that.
The first people who were shot were all protesters.
Okay, I think what's disputed is whether there was an intentional provocation of the people who did the shooting of the protesters. I believe that's the claim, but I don't know. I will direct people to Wikipedia and everywhere else.
I have not heard that seriously presented in the Ukrainian.
Do you think that the U.S. had in any sense a policy of wanted to encourage regime change in Ukraine at that point?
I need to think. I mean, obviously, they were in favor of democracy in Ukraine, and it was democracy that was in danger. Mm-hmm. Ukraine did have a democratic parliament, and Yanukovych never had 2/3 majority in mm-hmm. the the parliament. He had a majority, but not the so-called constitutional majority of two-thirds. So this was happy-as-you-go democracy, which was quite unstable. And the question was rather, would democracy persist or not?
Mm-hmm. And, you know, you said, I agree, there was a lot of genuine popular support for the revolution. I assume you'd agree that it was disproportionately representative of kind of Western Ukraine, Kyiv, and so on. In Eastern Ukraine, there was a lot of ambivalence about it, especially when after the revolution, Parliament immediately passed laws that a lot of Easterners felt discriminated against the use of the Russian language and so on. And there's been a certain amount of this. And
this law was never confirmed. It was adopted by Parliament, but not signed in.
I know. And I think maybe the Westerners stepped in and kind of pointed out that it wouldn't be about it. But there have been, there are anti-Russian language laws that actually are on the books in Ukraine. And you don't deny that maybe it wasn't handled as well as it might have been in terms of not making the Easterners, the native Russian speakers, especially feel threatened by the new the government that had taken power through revolution.
Russia has lots of ethnic minorities and probably 5 million Ukrainians, and it has no Ukrainian schools.
Okay. And just quickly, I wanted to drill down on something when you said Putin had called for genocide. People define genocide in so many different ways these days. I'm just curious as to which statement of Putin's you're referring to.
Yeah, I shouldn't say that Putin has not used the word genocide himself, but he has called, for example, for bombing of civilians, terror bombing of civilians. And of the infrastructure. He said it as late as yesterday in the Kremlin. You can look it up.
You mean he said we want to bomb civilians and kill civilian people or civilian infrastructure?
He said the civilian infrastructure, but he has made so many statements. I mean...
Okay. Just quickly, and this is only at my hand because I highlighted in the newsletter. Look, I don't defend any of this stuff, including bombing... infrastructure, but Putin's claim is that it's, you know, dual use, that it also has military uses. And I just want to tell you, quote something from a NATO spokesman going back to Kosovo when the U.S. Bombed Serbia, which was a pretty clear violation of international law, big grievance of Russia's. Anyway, we bombed Serbia's infrastructure, and somebody at a press conference asked NATO spokesman about that. And said, wait, 70% of these people are without electricity or water. And the NATO spokesman said, yes, I'm afraid electricity also drives command and control systems. If President Milosevic really wants all his population to have water and electricity, all he has to do is accept NATO's 5 conditions and we will stop this campaign. But as long as he doesn't do so, we will continue to attack those targets which provide the electricity for his armed forces. If that has civilian consequences, it's for him to deal with. So would you say NATO was guilty of genocide?
Yes, sir, I shouldn't use genocide in this context. I'm against terror bombing, full stop.
So you're not saying Putin called for genocide?
No, but what he did in his article of the 12th of July last year, he denied that Ukraine is a nation. And he denied all rights of Ukrainians. He did so already in his speech at all places, the NATO summit in Bucharest in April 2008. He said so also to Bush there, that the Ukrainians are not a people. And the very title of his July 12th article is... the unity of the Russian and Ukrainian people. And then they have terror bombed essentially Russian inhabited areas. I mean, Kharkiv and Kherson are very much Russian speaking territories of Ukraine.
Yeah, I don't want to get too deeply into this, but do you know that they were intentionally targeting the civilian targets? Because in a lot of cases, these are cities that are inhabited by the soldiers they're fighting. And in that sense, we've done, well, I mean, if you go back to World War II, of course,
if you take WHO has something, I think it's 500.
Okay. I mean, medical
establishments that have been bombed by the Russia. So the Russians are doing exactly the same as they did in Syria on the hospitals.
Okay. I'm not defending anything Russia's doing, beginning with the invasion itself, which is a clear violation of international law. I only ask about your use of the word genocide is because it's very emotionally charged. People use it very loosely, and then they deploy it rhetorically in a way that almost deprives people of their rational capacity. Once you convince them that somebody's committing or favoring genocide, it's like, all bets are off. It's like, well, we must do, you see my point.
Yeah, but you also have this activity that they have deported thousands of children, Ukrainian children, to be adopted by Russian parents, to be absorbed into the Russian population. And the Ukrainian number is more than 2.5 million Ukrainians that have been deported. Yeah. To Russia. You can quibble about how many are voluntary and also what given, but these are massive.
And there was a long piece in the New York Times about the adoption story that made it seem more complicated than it's sometimes depicted as being. And you're right, the question of how many of these are involuntary is not always addressed. But I don't, look, the whole thing is horrible. I don't deny that. I just wondered about use of the word genocide. So quickly, we've been talking a while, and I appreciate your patience. In the piece, my argument was that first of all, ending the war now, assuming it's even possible, and of course you doubt that any deal with Putin is doable, and we can talk about that. But if you just for purposes of argument assume that a deal could happen. My argument was that as it's truly regrettable to ever let anyone who invades a sovereign nation in violation of international law hang on to any of the territory, but there's a real possibility, I think, if the war continues, that Russia will ultimately take more territory as mobilization proceeds. There's a possibility that there will be basically a stalemate, in which case just a bunch more Ukrainians will die for no good reason, and the borders will never move. And then if in some sense the best case happens and Ukraine starts pushing things toward Russia's borders, there's the danger that Putin will see this, even if he doesn't see it as an existential threat to Russia, see it as an existential threat to his regime and start engaging in risky behavior that could lead to a wider war, even a nuclear war. And of course, just there's the fact that every day the war goes on, some fluke could happen that turns it into something more catastrophic. So that's a basic argument. I guess maybe you don't feel a need to address that part of the argument since you don't...
Let me respond. I think that the natural end to this war is that Ukraine takes back all the territory, including Donbas and Crimea, and also Sevastopol, to get the cancer out. And I think that the natural consequence in Russia then is that Putin somehow loses power. And if Putin loses power, since this is a pure personal authoritarian regime, I think that the regime will collapse. And I think then various ethnic territories of Russia are likely to depart, as Yegor Gaidar predicted in his book, Collapse of Empire, that was published here by Brookings in 2007. So I think that we are likely to see a profound collapse of Russia after this. I would presume that most of Russia, say 80% of the population, will hang together. But Putin has really destroyed his country, and this will have consequences for Russia.
Okay, a couple of things. I mean, first of all, it sounds like one version of the scenario you're embracing is Russia dissolves into ethnic civil war. I mean, that's a real possibility then, right?
Yeah. This is what happens when you pursue such policy as Putin has.
But when tons of people will die who otherwise wouldn't die, and you seem not to be as bothered by that as I am.
I'm just analyzing. If you brutalize people as much as Putin has done, then they become brutal.
But you're encouraging a policy that, by your own account, would lead to tons of these poor, innocent, brutalized people to die in a civil war.
I'm not saying civil war necessarily. I say that I think that it will is likely to dissolve. We saw that when the Soviet Union dissolved, that it was surprisingly peaceful. We can't know whether it will be bloody or not, but Putin has made all preparations for it to be very, very bloody. But this kind of regime will cause trouble all around otherwise. This is exactly as with Hitler's Nazi regime. This is a regime that needs to go.
And you acknowledge there's a good chance that if it goes the way you want it to, which is via us putting pressure on Putin by supporting the Ukrainian military effort well beyond a point where, by my lights, it gets risky in the sense that Putin could use nuclear weapons or something. You not only minimize the threat of the nuclear thing, you acknowledge that even if that doesn't happen, there's a good chance of a civil war that kills a lot of people, and you're still in favor of that because you think in some sense it just kind of has to happen.
I was very much in favor of communists falling in the Soviet Union and the dissolution of the Soviet Union. And I was very happy to see it. I was living and working in Moscow 1987 and kept closely in touch with it before and after. And that attitude was considered to be very dangerous by people like you then. I'm agnostic to what happens inside Russia after Putin has fallen. We saw in 91 that it was perfectly peaceful. So I have a lot of hope for Russia. What the opinion polls say is one-third liberal, European-oriented, one-third backward Putinistas, and one-third who are quite agnostic and apolitical and do not take a political stand.
Mm-hmm. There's also, I mean, aside from civil war, the question of within Russia, even assuming, I don't know how likely it is that Russia would just, that all the dissolution into these neat ethnic enclaves would happen peacefully. I think there's basically no chance. When you look at the actual map of ethnicities, you know how these things go. There aren't clean lines. But that aside, I think there would be this bloody civil war. That aside, just focusing on the question of regime change within whatever remained of Russia per se, a lot of people think that something at least as bad as Putin would come along. And let's assume that part happens peacefully through a palace coup or something. That might not happen. But if it did, I think a lot of people think that if the if the cause of the demise of the regime was failing to prosecute this war successfully, there's a good chance that you would have somebody at least as nationalist and authoritarian in the end as Putin. Do you acknowledge that as a real possibility?
No, not at all. I think that this is a completely flawed thinking. We have seen this repeatedly in Russian history. Nicholas I started the Crimean War 1853 to 1856. Mm-hmm. In came very liberal Tsar Alexander II, the greatest reform period under the Tsars. The Russia-Japanese War 1904-1905 led to the first election of a state Duma, not fully democratic, of course, but a substantial liberalization of Russia. And after Stalin, people feared that Beria would take over and it would get even worse. Instead, it was Khrushchev who took over. After Brezhnev, people were worrying about the hardliners in the wings. Instead, it became Gorbachev and Yeltsin, who led to the most liberal period in Russia ever. So the historical precedent suggests that this is not the risk. And also, if you take it logically, that Putin is a real extremist. And we see worse extremists on the Russian television because Putin promotes them. We know enough about the public opinion to know that these people don't have any popular support. And therefore, it's very unlikely that they would happen. And with regard to nuclear arms, Hitler had plenty of chemical arms that he didn't use during World War II. Instead, he committed suicide because he couldn't see that the chemical arms would help him in any way. And I can't see that Putin can benefit from nuclear arms. And like you, I think that he has some rationality, even if he disinforms himself intentionally.
Yeah, well, there is the so-called escalate to de-escalate idea where you use a tactical nuclear weapon to get everybody's attention. And they say, hold on, let's stop this war. And that's what you want, which is okay. I mean, there are worse things than that if it works, even though people die. But if it doesn't work, you know, you might wind up in a nuclear war. And I mean, I think this is part of Russian thinking.
I'm not afraid of that because the Ukrainians are not afraid of nuclear war. And the 90% of the Ukrainians think they will win. And they are prepared to do what it takes. So my peace proposal is give the Ukrainians as much arms as possible so that this war can be speeded up. Stalemate is what I'm worried for, because that could be a beginning of the next war.
Yeah, it's true they're optimistic. I think historically, if you look back, you would have to say that how optimistic a people is about their chances of prevailing in a war is not necessarily a good guide.
But this is driving them now.
What's that?
True, but it's driving them now.
Well, I know, but the question is, I mean, I'm not clear on why we should respect, why we should take that as a good, I mean, especially, you know, as you know, governments always try to control information during wars. Ukraine is doing it pretty effectively. As you know, they've shut down every TV station except one, which has the state narrative. And they're presenting an optimistic view of things. That's what governments do. They're doing it very effectively. I just wouldn't accept the prevailing view in Ukraine of how likely success is as a good guide to how likely success is.
No, but this is how the Ukrainians act. I was in Kiev last in September, and people are adamant. And
No, I agree. The morale is high, and the intensity of the spirit is admirable. I agree. So, I guess
should we stop so?
Yeah. I just want to say one more thing, and then give you a chance to reply. First of all, I admire your optimism about how well regime change would go, leaving aside the civil war question, which you acknowledge is a real possibility. And you're right that the Soviet breakup went, in the short term, about as well as could be expected. In the long run, we wound up with Ukraine, at least where we are now, as a consequence of that. And I just want to be clear on my own view. I have no illusions about how nice a guy Putin is or whatever. But I do believe that the U.S. has systematically mismanaged its relationship with Russia, beginning with NATO expansion in the 90s, continuing through a number of things Bush did. And I think, for example, that, you know, look, Ukraine and the EU was a very delicate situation. I don't believe this is just about NATO. The EU is a very delicate situation. I think there an effort should have been made to make a special arrangement with Ukraine that gave it benefits of economic interaction with the EU, but did not threaten its economic engagement with Russia, which, of course, would have happened. I mean, Ukraine, if it had, you know, in accepting the associate membership, would have been ultimately buying into a situation where the EU gets to decide what its whole tariff structure is with respect to Russia. I think a creative solution should have been sought there. It wasn't. But the main thing I want to emphasize is I'm not saying as of January it was going to be easy to avoid this war. I think more of an effort should have been made. I think more of an effort should have been made in November, in July, and so on. I agree that as February of this year approached, it got harder and harder and more challenging to do the things that Putin wanted that would have avoided the war, especially given the domestic political constraints that Biden faced. But just to be clear, my own view, I think the U.S. has systematically failed to put itself in the shoes of Russia and understand what kinds of policies were going to increase the chances of things like this happening. Lots of people warned us, you know, starting with George Kennan, including Bill Burns. One consistent thing about our policy is we never listened. We never listened up until February. And I think that's why we are where we are. And now I'll give you a chance to say that I'm wrong. But no, you've already said that. You've already said that. So say something else.
And say that what the U.S. should have done is massive armament of Ukraine before February 2022. I think that could have scared Putin off. With regard to the EU, I follow that very closely. Putin and the Kremlin couldn't care less about the EU until June 2013. Then all of a sudden they got upset about it. They want, very much like the US, Russia doesn't understand the European Union, think that it's an old bureaucracy. So why bother about it? Putin and the Kremlin always wanted to have direct links with the big countries in Europe, France and Germany, previously Britain, and tries to avoid the EU. So therefore, no EU policy would have been taken seriously in the Kremlin. And Barroso, even had when he was president of the European Commission, was hated by Putin, who wanted to see him as little as possible. So there was no way forward there.
Okay, let me just quickly violate my pledge to shut up. just say, on the one point of your saying we should have armed Ukraine more rapidly, well, we were arming them at a certain velocity, and I really believe that, I mean, Putin said that was one reason he was invading. I think he's right. Now, it may be that he was going to invade in any event, and he said, well, if they're going to keep sending weapons in, the sooner the better. But anyway, and I think this is relevant to Taiwan, it's a double-edged sword to start sending weapons in, because if a country is worried about those weapons ultimately leading to a degree of threat or formidability or whatever that's unacceptable, they're going to say, well, let's invade now. So there is that dilemma.
Sure.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you so much, Anders.
Thank you. Nice
I must say, I enjoy talking to you much more than I enjoy reading your Twitter threads about things I write. So maybe,
okay, you're welcome.
Maybe we'll talk
again. Start this conversation.
Okay. Take care.
Have a nice weekend.
You too.